This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about architecture in Indiana to learn about some of the great old buildings you can find in cities and towns across the state, how we fit into the larger story of American architecture and new development projects that are inspired by the past. To help us do it, we're joined by two professors today from the School of Architecture at the University of Notre Dame, Chris Wilson and Philip Bess. Welcome to both of you. Chris, I'll start with you. How did you get interested in architecture? What sparked this passion for you?
My mother had an interest in history. She didn't get to go to college right out of high school, but went back when my youngest sister was in kindergarten. And she used to bring home the mimeograph notes from one of her history professors. And I would listen to, as an 11-year-old, listen to his lectures on the college radio station. So that instilled an interest in history. And then as an undergraduate, I was a slide projectionist as my student job and hooked up with a really great architectural historian who kind of gave me a way of looking at the built environment and seeing history and culture in the built environment.
Philip, what about you?
I'm one of these people who had an undergraduate degree in another in a field other than architecture, and I never really even considered becoming an architect until in sort of my early mid-20s. I was working on a construction project with a couple of guys who had designed the building, and I thought, oh, this would be kind of interesting. So I liked the idea of it of architecture as a kind of wedding of contemplation and craft, and so that set me on a course of architectural study, which I would say the chief benefit of which is just kind of learning how to see the built environment. It wasn't something that I had paid much attention to, honestly, until I went to architecture school. And that's a great benefit of architecture school.
When I think of architecture, generally, I just think of blueprints and rulers and numbers. Is that accurate, or is there something more to it than that, Chris?
Well, that's the case with architect-designed buildings, civic buildings, large commercial buildings, the houses and mansions of the well-to-do. But a lot of what gets built are by vernacular means, builders who just come up in the building trades and build houses. And then over the last century, contractor builders, popular ways of designing and building. So there's a range of kind of learned architect design buildings and then other pragmatic approaches to different building types.
And Philip, how would you characterize the architecture in South Bend compared to other places in Indiana? And maybe we can sort of broaden it a little bit in terms of, like, when you're characterizing architecture, is this just the outward appearance? Is it the way that it's built? Is it the materials?
It's a great question, and it's kind of a complex answer. South Bend has been around for 150 years or so, and so there are buildings that have been here before the turn of the 20th century, and also very good ones that were built in the early period of the 20th century, and I want to some extent that period of American architectural history between about 1880 and 1940, there were really good buildings built almost everywhere in every region. It was America's, in some ways, America's best period of architectural production. And South Bend had a lot of those buildings. It still has some of those buildings left. What happened was in the 60s, a couple of things. One is that Studebaker closed down in South Bend and caused a serious economic recession within the city. A lot of people were thrown out of work. And then there was just a general national policy of post-World War II urban renewal that entailed the federal government giving cities a lot of money to tear down blocks of so-called, they called them slums, but the cities were in need of money, and they did. And South Bend has never really recovered from that, or is only beginning to recover from that. So that South Bend is characterized by a lot of gaps in the block structure of the city, a lot of vacant blocks, And that has started to turn around. And I imagine we'll maybe talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, definitely. And Chris, what was your impression of the architecture in South Bend when you moved there?
I was very impressed. I have lived and taught in New Mexico, which is a relatively poor state. And so right off the bat, the wealth of Indiana and the wealth of South Bend, from great farmland, but also from manufacturing from the middle of the 19th to, you know, into the middle of the 20th century, produced such wealth that there's a lot of high quality architecture, really wonderful houses. And people that begin to learn about architecture think first about style. It's visual. You can engage it. So the Greek Revival, Italianate, Queen Anne, neoclassical houses, but also the building types, which get into economic and social layers. So the downtowns with their business blocks, with commercial space, shops on the ground floor, and then office or residential above. And I would say, not just South Bend, but the smaller towns on a smaller scale, tend to have, great historic downtowns with those business blocks. They tend to have great residential neighborhoods, or sometimes it's a main highway road running out of the town that's lined by great mansions. But as Phil said, urban renewal took down really a kind of donut of space around the downtowns, what were viewed as substandard multifamily housing. And those, in most cases, remain as surface parking lots to this day.
Wow. So it kind of changed the dynamic of the area in a way.
Yeah, it did, absolutely. And of course, it goes hand in hand with suburbanization and white flight to the suburbs after the Second World War, supported by federal regulation and financing mechanisms that channeled resources into the suburbs.
Phil, how would you characterize the architecture in South Bend compared to other parts of the state?
Well, let's see. I mean, I would say that one of the things that is a benefit of being at Notre Dame is that we have a great librarian, and one of the projects that she's done through the Architecture School Library is to document what South Bend looked like prior to about 1960. And it was really extraordinary. The quality of the streets, the quality of the buildings, both the public buildings and the kinds of mixed-use buildings that Chris describes, the housing stock. It was really quite superb. And I actually think that this was characteristic of most pre-1945 towns everywhere, including Indiana, so that. In my experience of looking around small towns in northern Indiana, they're very a lot of them, they're very similar to each other, but there's a kind of uniform quality to them that existed prior to 1945. They were compact. They had a main street. They had civic buildings and often a public square. And they were really quite attractive places that now have gaps in them that, again, because of suburbanization, the devaluation of downtown small towns, it's affected big cities and small towns. And so when you go to small towns now, you see these gaps. But generally, you'll find a lot of places where the main street is intact. The buildings might not be completely full, but the aesthetic quality of them is quite good. What they need is economic activity, and they need a financial basis for thriving. But the small town characters is really quite good.
It makes me wonder: does architecture influence a town and the way it's going to be built out? I mean, let's say there's no planner there planning out the city, but is it influenced by architecture, or does the town influence the way the architecture is going to come about?
Well, I would say a lot of what influences it is zoning and local habits of building, contemporary habits of building, which I said local habits of building, but the habits of building have become similar across the country in a certain kind of way, and not for the better. Chris mentioned the whole issue of suburban sprawl. And one of the consequences of that is that that's been going on for about 70 years at least. And one of the consequences of that is that we have developed zoning laws that produce that. And we've acquired habits of making places that are suburban. And so to try to work in the context of a traditional walkable mixed-use neighborhood, because that's really the difference between a post-war suburb and a city neighborhood or a small town, is that in the suburb you have to drive to all the different things that you do during the course of a day, whereas in a walkable town, you can walk to some things. Anyway, that it's very hard to do that and to make those kinds of environments now. These environments like traditional small towns, but one of the advantages of them is that they have their infrastructure intact, right? So and they have a lot of their buildings intact, and so there's a possibility for revival of small towns and city neighborhoods that can be locuses for infill development and rethinking this walkable mixed use pattern of life.
Right. I think we have a friend who wants to join us on the
call.
Sounds like
it, yeah.
Yeah, I just emailed my wife, who's in her office downstairs, asking for a little help with our exuberant dog. But Miriam, that's a really important and a complex question. Winston Churchill famously said, "First we shape our buildings, and then our buildings shape us." And so it's a chicken and an egg, kind of loop that keeps evolving but is reinforcing. Beyond buildings, looking at districts, the way in which the United States ethnic and racial groups have been historically segregated into separate neighborhoods, often then with schools that are kind of pitched towards the place in society, the sort of occupations mm-hmm. that those people are expected to fulfill, so that a person staying in their place is both social and spatial.
Well, we'll come back after a quick break and continue our conversation. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soap. We're talking about the architecture you can find in cities and towns across Indiana, and are joined by two professors from the School of Architecture at the University of Notre Dame, Chris Wilson and Philip Bess. Chris, when it comes to the Notre Dame campus, how does that feel within the city? Is there a separation at all between Notre Dame and South Bend when you look at buildings?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the end of your question? You broke up a little bit.
Is there a separation between Notre Dame and South Bend when you look at the buildings?
That's, I think, a very important question. In Europe, colleges and universities are integrated with cities. But in the United States, from Thomas Jefferson's plan from the University of Virginia on, the predominant form of universities is in isolated rural locations. Jefferson thought that the city was a bad moral influence, and so he wanted to keep the young people in a kind of sequestered environment. And so it's not at all unusual that the Notre Dame campus was originally sequestered from the city and separated from the city. Due south of the campus until only about 15 years ago, there were fields, there were woodlots, and it's in that period that some universities began to work hard to connect with their local community to develop kind of an entertainment and housing and office district at the edge of campus, and to also become more involved in supporting initiatives for South Bend in this case. And so the Eddy Street Common development started in 2005, kind of bridges that historic separation between Notre Dame and South Bend in a very effective way.
Phil, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, what Chris describes, I've been at Notre Dame since 2004, since January 2004. So I remember what it was like before Eddy Street Commons. And it's not only, I don't say it's energized the campus. It has. I mean, it's provided a place for students to go off campus that's very close. And so it begins to have a little more of the character of a college town. But which people often, when they come to Notre Dame, they're surprised. They imagine South Bend as being a college town, but that's not been the history of the relationship between the university and the town. But it's also had a ripple effect to the south, where there's been a lot of residential development that has taken place further south on Eddy Street. And it's also extending a little bit to the east and the west. So it's there's a peculiar kind of dynamic that exists, a peculiar kind of economic dynamic also that exists at Notre Dame because of the alumni and because of the football tradition. And that's having an impact upon local real estate values, which have been, let's see, you could call them stable or you could call them stagnant for a long time. But property values are rising, which is you know, a good aspect and a bad aspect. But I think that that generally speaking, the university and particularly the architecture school is trying to be more involved with the city. And the city in the last 10 years or so particularly has been open to that. In fact, the city's undertaken initiatives where they've really upgraded the infrastructure of downtown. South Bend used to be characterized by one-way arterials that were six lanes wide. Where, you know, if you were a pedestrian, your life was in danger. And those streets have been changed to become more pedestrian friendly while still handling, a sufficient volume of traffic. And they've also revised their zoning ordinance and to make it, we started to talk about this a little bit, to change away from use-based zoning to form-based zoning that's based on building form and density. Which has a variety of advantages that we can talk about if you want to. But both of these things are significant initiatives, and both of these things involved graduates of the Notre Dame School of Architecture who were instrumental in bringing these about. And it's having a very positive effect downtown, and our new dean, Stefanos Palazoides, has also been very active. He's been on the job for a couple of years and is very active in engaging the city of South Bend, who is very friendly toward these initiatives. And so, there's a lot of interesting things happening in South Bend. We like to call South Bend is a climate change refuge city. We'll see. But a lot of interesting things happening.
Do you have a favorite building?
Let's see. We have some classics downtown. A theater and a courthouse that are quite lovely, and a fine arts center. I'm actually kind of partial. It didn't start off all that well, but the baseball park on the southwest side of town has been there for goodness 30 years now. But under new ownership over the last 10 years, they've started to develop around it and make it. It's really Four Winds Field, they call it now, has won a lot of awards for being among the best, if not the best, minor league baseball parks in its class. And a lot of that just has to do with they recognize that actually it can support a lot of activity around it. And so the baseball park has become one of my favorite spots in South Bend.
What about you, Chris? Is there a specific building you're drawn to?
There's a beautiful 1850s Greek Revival courthouse downtown. And then I was very fortunate to lease a 1905 house in the River Bend neighborhood just east of Memorial Hospital. And, through the dark days of winter and the recent spike of COVID, that really nurtured me to have a historic house to knock around in and just enjoy the quality of space in that house.
I do want to touch upon earlier, I can't remember which one of you was mentioning, but that good buildings were everywhere between the 1880s and 1940s. And so, Chris, does that mean it's better to find old buildings and restore them and build from those or maintain them? Is it better in the long run than building something completely new?
There are certain advantages and arguments for historic buildings, but I would say, sustainable, resilient buildings today are starting to return to some of those lessons. So buildings that are adapted to the local climate, that are built solidly to last decades and centuries, not just a few years. And also just the fact that there's lots of embodied energy in historic buildings. They're already built. They're already standing. They tend to have more detail and higher quality in the workmanship. They're easier to love, and they contribute to stability and continuity in their immediate district or neighborhood.
Phil, what do you think the value of great architecture can have for a campus like Notre Dame, even for folks who may not even be thinking about it while they're there?
Oh, goodness. That's a great question. Human beings occupy space and time. And, we spend our lives in a built environment. If you understand that human beings is a certain kind of animal, a certain kind of intermediate animal, we would say, I think at Notre Dame that is in one sense part of nature, but in another way transcending nature and having obligations toward nature. If you understand human beings as that kind of animal, then you understand that the built environment is the way that the human animal occupies the landscape, and so there's a certain sense in which the built environment for human beings is natural in that sense, even though it's an artifact of human beings. And so when you realize that and you see, the great traditions, and one of the great things about Notre Dame and the architectural program at Notre Dame, which is, I don't know if we've mentioned this, Notre Dame's architecture program is unique in the world. Really, it's certainly the only classical and traditional school of architecture in the United States. But a large part of our education is sending students, not only teaching them to draw, but taking them to look at places, right? And so they all spend a year in Rome. All the undergraduates spend a year in Rome. All the graduates spend a semester in Rome. But there are extensive field trips throughout the United States, and the objective is to look at good places and understand their history. Understand how they work aesthetically, understand how they work in terms of their materials and structure. And as Chris mentioned, the idea of embodied energy is related to the fact that prior to the modern era, most buildings were built with locally sourced materials that were drawn relatively closely from the earth. And so they're pretty durable, right? I mean, piling up stones on top of each other, you pile up bricks on top of each other, And you do that in an artful way, and those buildings will stand for a long time. And so a place like Notre Dame in particular, I think students have such great associations with Notre Dame. It's really a remarkable place in that respect, that the students, there's a great love for Notre Dame, and they come to love it for its places. And you asked about favorite buildings in South Bend, but there's some really wonderful buildings and places on campus that students will think of, as in a certain way home. And I think that in a way, that's the magic. That's the importance of architecture. That's the importance of good campus design.
Chris, when it comes to Indiana, do you think that there's a particular aesthetic here for the type of architecture that we see?
Going back to something Phil said earlier about many of these patterns being shared nationally. And so, for instance, Indiana is settled by people coming out of the East Coast. There's a New England, upstate New York Yankee stream that comes west, and it's in the northern part of the state. Elkhart was settled by Yankees, for instance. And then there's a kind of German and English hearth in Pennsylvania. People migrate into Indiana, and Tidewater, Virginia to Kentucky and southern Indiana. And so these are vernacular patterns at first, and then once the railroad comes, factories and industrialization, then a lot of the styles are shared nationally, the building types, the patterns of developing a downtown and how residential neighborhoods are organized are shared. So I think of it as being more of an upper Midwest, kind of popular architecture of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Phil, when it comes to architectural trends in different regions across the country, how do you define them? I mean, could you look at photos of buildings and take a good guess where they're from?
Probably not as well as Chris, but I can do that, because buildings, they change from region to region depending upon whether it's hot, whether it's cold, whether it's arid, whether it's humid, what the local, building materials are. So it's not hard to notice those kinds of differences. It's also very easy, if you've been thinking about it for any amount of time, it's also very easy to tell when a building was built before 1940 and after 1950. There was just a complete change after the Depression and after World War II, and the creation of the post-war suburb that really was that dominates now. But we tend to forget that it's really an experiment, that human beings have never organized the built environment exclusively around the automobile, and so it's in one way it's a great convenience. It's become a cultural ideal, but we're still dealing with some of the ramifications of that, and will be for a while, but you can tell the differences.
That's fascinating. Just that you mentioned building communities around the automobile, and so that kind of changed the trajectory of things. I just wonder if we'll ever go back to a time when vehicles aren't the focus, unless you live in, I guess, a city where there's a lot of walking that you can do.
Well, that's the big question. I mean, I think that the idea of a walkable mixed use environment, it presents so many advantages if you're young, if you're old, if you're too poor to have a car, if you can do things, in your daily life that you don't have to have a car to do, then that's great. And if you're in an automobile suburb, you don't really have that advantage. You don't have that opportunity. But at the same time, I think that the ideal of the walkable mixed use environment is not, it's not anti-automobile. It's against the idea of designing the built environment for the automobile to the exclusion of the pedestrian. And so that's the kind of thing that we have to get back to. There's a whole other argument. It's interesting. We haven't really mentioned the Congress for the New Urbanism and the kinds of things that they've done in the last 30 years to promote walkable mixed use communities. But much of their focus has always been on the environmental impact of suburban sprawl and the consumption of farmland and of forests. But there's a whole other argument that comes from a newer organization called Strong Towns, which is really an economic argument. It's the argument is that the extensive suburban infrastructure the population density of the suburbs is too small to support that extensive an infrastructure. And so there's another issue that they focus on. But these are all things that we're dealing with now, and we will be dealing with them for a while.
On the flip side of that, when we think of small towns across Indiana and the country, we may not realize that they've been struggling economically for years. Chris, we have about a minute left before we jump to break. If you could just get us started off with how challenging it is to save historic buildings in these places.
Well, it's really tough. A lot of those smaller local businesses and industries that fueled the wealth and the development of fine towns, have lost out. First, there were waves of consolidation in the early 20th century. And then, of course, in more recent decades, even jobs being shifted overseas. So a lot of these communities, and especially a lot of the downtowns, lost their economic reason for being. You know, first the development of the shopping mall, and then the development of Amazon really took the wind out of the sails of the locally owned businesses in the downtown. So there have been these strong, you know, economic currents, you know, young people going where the jobs are, going, migrating to the larger cities. And so, you know, I look forward to talking about some of the counter developments of revitalizing smaller towns in recent years.
All right. We'll definitely pick back up on that after a quick break. We're talking with experts about architecture in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing architecture in Indiana, efforts to preserve our past and new development inspired by our past. With us again, two professors from the School of Architecture at the University of Notre Dame, Chris Wilson and Philip Bess. Chris, before the break, we started to talk a little bit about small towns. And I wanted to know a little bit more about the small towns you're familiar with and what makes them interesting and why are we having such a hard time, I guess, reclaiming this past history?
Well, some of the things that I touched on earlier, you know, first, the shift to the suburbs in the 1950s and 60s, we're an independent, mobile people. We like that. And so people have gravitated to the suburb. And in trying to revitalize inner cities and older, more pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods, not everybody's going to be attracted to that. And part of the new urbanism and smart growth and historic preservation movements are trying to develop alternatives to suburbia, things that are more pedestrian-oriented, more face-to-face. And so, for instance, there's a national program known as Main Street, which is economic redevelopment of downtowns. And, Indiana Office of Community and Rural Affairs has its program, Indiana Main Street, which focuses on improving the infrastructure, making sure that the streets and sewers and the broadband are all up to snuff in an area, recruiting and supporting local business development, supporting marketing for that downtown, providing economic and preservation technical assistance as one strategy to create historic commercial districts as, in a sense, entertainment destinations.
I wonder, too, though, sometimes when we hear the words like historic preservation, Phil, I know you've been involved in some preservation efforts in New Mexico, but it sometimes seems complicated. It's like, well, you could either tear down this whole thing and build something new, or you have to do this historic preservation where you have to follow every code and have like the same type of things that were there back in the past. So can you tell us a little bit more about that, I guess?
well, Chris is probably more qualified to speak about that. Is more qualified to speak about that than I am. But they're, you know, one of the interesting things about the historic preservation movement is that it was really prompted by modernism. It was prompted by, in a way, there are good reasons to pursue it, which have to do with the quality of older buildings themselves, their quality of construction, the quality of their details. It's also a kind of reaction to the shoddy construction practices that have become characteristic of the contemporary building industry. And that's not uniform, but it's kind of common. It's you know, there's a kind of a kind of a developer standard in big scale projects, which are increasingly the kinds of projects that are being done even in not only in large cities, but in medium sized cities. So to a certain extent, opportunities to do good buildings, to do good new buildings and to rehab good old buildings are much more common in small towns than in you know, even medium-sized cities to some extent. I just read, there was just an article over the weekend in the Chicago Tribune about Quincy, Illinois, which I think is not unique in this respect, but what was particularly interesting is that they have a kind of program to attract young professionals. Quincy, Illinois is a river town in western Illinois, Mississippi River town. And they do things like, you know, provide cash bonuses for young professionals to move into town. I mean, some of the infrastructure things that Chris was talking about in the Main Streets institution is really interesting. I mean, small towns have got to become and are becoming creative. And it's really interesting in how this will play out after COVID, too, because I think a lot of I think that people are a little worried about life in big cities, particularly if they're not from big cities. I think that big cities have a lot to offer, but there's an urban way of life that is a small town way of life, and what traditional urban neighborhoods and what traditional small towns have in common is that they're walkable mixed use environments. And so I think that there are a lot of opportunities in small towns if they can figure out what they do well, because obviously there's an economic basis without which they cannot function. Although there's a little more flexibility these days given the opportunities for remote working, and so with creative kind of zoning policies and creative programs to attract talent. It's not a bad thing. I think there's also, it's really important. I think we're going to see increasingly the importance of living near, a productive agricultural landscape. And that's one of the things that really, well, I joked a little earlier about South Bend as a climate change refuge city, but I think one of the great things about South Bend, Indiana and the Michiana region is its proximity to a very good, agricultural, landscape. There's a lot of great things that are produced here and produced by local farmers, and that in some ways there's probably going to be more of that and a need for more of that, but it's really critical to the life of any small town as well.
Chris, my apologies for mischaracterizing the work that you do. Can you tell about why it's important to preserve and sometimes restore buildings? Some people might say, well, time is done, now we got to build up something new. Why keep it around?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's part of a rich culture to have continuity, to have community connections, to have human connections, to have a community and a personal history grounded in place. It enriches and it ennobles society. And so I think that's why there are a range of government programs and nonprofit programs and universities that work on this. Earlier you were asking about, the cost of adaptive reuse of historic buildings, preservation of historic buildings. And the State Department of Historic Preservation and Archaeology, for instance, is available with technical assistance on materials and structures. The federal government has a 20% tax credit for the preservation and adaptive reuse of income-producing properties, for instance. Indiana's fortunate to have one of the leading nonprofit preservation organizations in the country, Indiana Landmarks. It's a group with headquarters in Indianapolis, but I think half a dozen or maybe more regional offices around the states, over 6,000 members. And again, they provide technical assistance and grants and loans. I think one of their most successful programs is to purchase historic buildings that need a little bit of help to get reused. And so they will purchase a house, they'll purchase an old factory, they will address basic structural issues, sometimes put a new roof on it, put a coat of paint on the outside, and then put it on the market and resell it, often to people that are willing to kind of put their sweat equity into finishing the inside of the house. And so lots of houses have been turned over that way. in Terre Haute recently, the Miller Perot Baking Company. Indiana Landmarks partnered with the Sisters of Providence to adapt that four-story factory building into affordable senior housing in Terre Haute. Or similarly, in Wabash, Indiana Landmarks has focused some energy. They've purchased in the last year seven historic houses, and many of those are going on the market, and individuals are buying them. But one of them, a nonprofit organization, Waypoint, was formed to develop housing for a kind of drug abuse residential treatment center for women in that community. And they took a large old Second Empire style mansion and turned it into a 24-unit residential treatment center.
I want to kind of move on and talk about some of the new development projects. And I know earlier we kind of talked about how maybe some of the things that are built now are made cheaper with cheaper materials, and that's why they don't last as long as buildings in the past. Phil, what does it take for developers to value the aesthetics of what they're making if it's cheaper to build things in another way?
I think that the best developers, the best projects, the best developer-driven projects that I know of have been done by people who are residents of the community, and they're in place to some extent, and so they're neighbors, right? They have a stake in the place that they're developing, and so. That's something that I've found to be the case in a number of places that I take students to and that I sort of show students as models of development. But beyond that, it's also a function of zoning. It's a function of what's permitted and making it possible to make walkable mixed use environments. Which the problem is that most zoning codes. And this is changing, but most zoning codes have made it illegal to make walkable mixed-use environments because it separates uses. And so one of the big things, one of the great accomplishments, I would say, of the Congress for the New Urbanism is pioneering a different form of zoning that zones according to building type and density. And so there's been some success in that. So there are a lot of developers out there who are willing to do that. The quality of construction thing is still kind of a tough nut to crack. I mean, for one thing, we're in the midst of shortages and supply chain disruptions and labor shortages in the construction industry right now. But there's also a kind of industry standard construction that means that buildings get built in a certain kind of way because it's you can't be competitive if you're a builder and you don't build in that way. And so to some extent, what's required in order to start to move that, shift that a little bit, is for clients who are institutions who are going to be around for a while, who own land and who have time to develop things slowly and incrementally, have a great opportunity to contribute to a recreation of a culture of durable building. And that's one of the things that we talk about a lot at Notre Dame. And I don't want to give the impression that Notre Dame graduates are not involved in the construction industry as it exists, because they certainly are. But at the same time, we're looking for opportunities to find projects where they can be kind of laboratories, right? And where they can demonstrate by doing the quality of construction that will actually last a long time and retain buildings that will retain their value for a long time. And so it's an interesting environment, but you have to look for opportunities to nudge the needle toward a better quality of construction.
Chris, are there any efforts you know about to build structures inspired by the past, modeled after old architecture in the community?
Yeah, there are many, but as Phil suggested, Notre Dame is unique in really focusing on the classical form of historic architecture. Most American architecture schools, and probably 90%, are modernists. They emphasize avant-garde expression of changing conditions. They think in terms of freestanding buildings in suburbia. And yet, if we're going to have a sustainable, resilient country, if we're going to cut carbon emissions and help to start curb global climate change, we've got to look to the pre-automobile way of building, mixed use, denser, pedestrian-oriented. In fact, the energy consumption in a city like Manhattan is like a third of what it is in suburbia. And even our historic towns and neighborhoods, because of people having to drive shorter distances, being able to walk places, apartment buildings where you're sharing walls and roofs, which cut down on heating costs, there's just much less energy consumption. And so it's not just about historic preservation, but it's about finding ways of designing denser, mixed-use, pedestrian-oriented neighborhoods that work for real estate investment and the construction industry. And there are certain building types that have come online in the last generations. You know, I'm sure people recognize the kind of 4 or 5 story building, again, like the business block with shop space on the ground floor, maybe a parking structure at the back of the lot or on the second floor. And then residents above. That's become a real estate development formula that helps us move toward having the alternative of mixed-use, pedestrian-oriented, more energy-conserving neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think I've heard a lot about mixed-use lately in other programs, other places, and it seems like that's sort of the wave of the future in a way. But I wonder with the way the pandemic has shaped things, if that might change a little.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a challenge, and we're all watching closely. And I'll just say, I moved to South Bend the first week of January, and I immediately tuned into the local PBS station WVPN, and loved the mix of local, state, national, international programs. And Miriam, especially your program, All In, for the way that you look day after day at the ramifications of the pandemic, economic, social, mental health, technological change, extremely valuable contribution you've made. And so I'm sure I'm joined by all the longtime listeners of your program and being very sad that the program has been cut for budgetary reasons. So I just wanted to thank you for the contribution you and everyone at All In have made.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we really appreciate all the comments and the folks that have reached out. And on that note, I'm going to have to wrap up and say thank you to both of you for taking the time to join us today. Chris Wilson and Philip Bess are professors at the School of Architecture in the University of Notre Dame. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. You can always reach out to us via voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.